Welcome to What's Your Story podcast. I'm your host, Matt Story. On this pod, I sit down with people of color leaders to understand how they've been able to use their superpowers to make an impact on our world. And I do it one story at a time. Today's guest on the pod is Jerry Wan, CEO and founder of Just Like Media. And for those of you that may not be familiar with Just Like Media, it's an Asian American storytelling platform that has a number of podcast brands that really focus on shining a light on the Asian American lived experience. And Jerry and I were connected through a mutual colleague and had the chance to sit on a panel together. And in the prep sessions and our time on the panel and even afterwards, I was just blown away by his authenticity and how he truly leans into his unique voice and finds ways to bring his unique voice to bear that can help others understand how they can play a role in really driving towards a more inclusive and equitable world. And Jerry walks us through in this conversation his journey of how he started out as a salesperson. He then decided to go back and get his MBA to have a more traditional career and more importantly, traditional salary. And then join the consulting world, which, you know, a lot of us can get into and realize that it's something that, you know, it's hard to get out of once you start, you know, getting some of those perks and those benefits of it. But I think for him, he was really forced to take a look at what he was doing and the impact he was making. And I'm glad to say that I can see why he made the right choice to really step out and create this platform, not only for himself, but for so many others to participate and even more importantly, to see themselves in. And so this is a great conversation. It's one that I really enjoyed. And I think you'll take away quite a few gems from the discussion. So with that, let's get on to his story. Okay, so my guest on the pod today he's just a dope storyteller. I can run through the things he's done. I can share all the accolades and I'll include that in the intro and in the notes, but I just want to recognize him for being one of the dope storytellers that I look to in the industry to hopefully improve what I'm doing. But, you know, he's also built an Asian American storytelling company that serves as a platform for many other Asian Americans to not only share their stories, but I think more importantly to hear their stories and to feel seen and represented. So I was really excited to talk to him and get to know more about his journey. So with that as an intro, I'd like to welcome Jerry Wan to the show.
Oh, Matt, thank you so much. You know, I was chuckling. So I love the word dope personally. The one person in my life who hates that word is my wife. So
nice.
Every time I say it, she's like, what are you, 12? And I was like, exactly. No. I probably learned it when I was 12. But for those of us in this age demographic, I love that word. So
it along with interesting is a word that I feel like I can use for so many different things. And so, yeah, it is definitely my go-to. Yeah, there you go. So thank you for taking the time to join me. Before we jump into some of the things you're up to and what you've been doing, I'd love it if you could give a little bit of context on your background and, you know, just share a glimpse into maybe what little Jerry was.
You know, little Jerry wasn't born Jerry. I was born Jonghun in Korea in 83, and our family moved here in 92. I was actually named Jerry because named after the mouse. Couldn't sit still, always busy. And so when my parents were suggested, or my parents, you know, they were suggested by family and other friends in the community, like, hey, you know, we got to give these kids an American name. They said, oh, that's easy. We'll just name it after, you know, and the J alliteration between my Korean name and Jonghun and Jerry. My brother is Jongho and his English name Jay. That's what they went with. You know, so we, in short, we moved to Fullerton, California, which is a suburb here in Los Angeles. Went through junior high here, moved to New York City for my father's job. So ended up going to high school in New York City, came back West Coast for college, and sort of been out here on the West Coast ever since. You know, interestingly, I think like very many other Asian immigrant kids, you know, we were expected to study hard. We were expected to go to a great school. And as it was in my case, my father is a physician. So it was sort of, you know, don't you want to be a doctor too, like your dad? And so, you know, I guess to sum it up, like knowing For those of you who don't know, I run a media company and I speak for a living, particularly on the topics of being an Asian American. Like that's a really, really weird place to end up for, not a weird, but an interesting place to end up, as we just shared, for an immigrant kid whose parents, I think they know how I make my money these days, but yeah. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. So I do want to go back because It's fascinating, as you said, you know, family members recommending that you, you know, take on a American name, if you will. Did you know that at the time? Were you a part of the discussion, or was that something that was told to you later?
I don't remember. I don't remember if I had a say in the selection of Jerry or even in that notion. But I do think, you know, and I don't think any parent ever, particularly as you know, we're parents now, right? Like, we don't ever want anything bad for our kids. So I think about what our parents must have wanted for us as new Americans or as new immigrants in this world of how do we make it as easy as possible for these guys, these two young kids, to thrive in this new environment. And I think one of them was, let's try to make them at least blend in with a name, right? So, you know, we see, so we moved to Fullerton because my uncle was there. I have three cousins on that, or I guess, you know, in that family, and they all had English names. And so I think it was just like, okay, well, let's follow suit. Pronunciation, sort of acceptance or blending in. I don't think it was a word that my parents or anybody in that generation really understood, but what they were practicing was assimilation. What they were practicing was, let's try to, you know, in their own well intent, try to make these guys as white as possible, really, to try to, you know, blend in, right? Because what my parents wanted for me, and particularly my mother, was study hard, go to a good school, and go work for a big, large American company. Because in the Korean context, if you weren't going to be a doctor or a lawyer, going to a large conglomerate like a Samsung or a Hyundai back in the day, post-war especially, was really the safe path to financial security and social, you know, respect, if you will. And so, you know, I don't know. I've struggled with the name thing, especially as of late, especially knowing that being Jerry has no difference or makes no difference in whether somebody wants to punch me in the face or not, right? Like, nobody asked you, nobody cares, right? You know, two children, 4 and 2, they both have English and Korean names. Their Korean names are their middle names. And often think about, like, what is the legacy I want to leave for them? How much of their culture and their heritage do I want them to be a part that proud of? With all these things, I've given much thought and just pondered about, you know, people and friends from the Black community, especially in the civil rights era, that gave their children very African or very Black names. And when I was much younger, Matt, I would always think, why would they name their kids something that would objectively make their lives more difficult?
Yeah.
One, because it's hard to pronounce. Just, you know, it's not a Tom or a John. Yeah. But two, society discriminates based on names and makes assumptions about somebody's either race or socioeconomic background purely based on their names, often to the point where it is, you know, spoken about in pop culture or even ridiculed at times, right? And so, and then, you know, as I grew older, it's like, because their parents didn't care about what that meant, they cared more about being who they were, being proud of who they were, and they cared really deeply more about being authentic in themselves. Yeah. And so names are so fascinating, I think, is a part of an integral part of our story. Yeah, so I've thought about it, you know. I think particularly as in the last year, you know, experiencing and talking about and being a part of the community that has experienced so much hate and violence, it's like, well, how much pride am I earning back? How Korean do I want to be? Do I, you know, legally my name is Jerry, but so many immigrants, particularly Asian, have always been asked the question of what's your real name? Yeah. Like, as far as you're concerned, my name is Jerry, you know? So the names are interesting, but I don't know where I want to end with, you know, I don't know where I sit now, but yeah, names are fascinating. And I think it is part of, I don't know if I want to say it so bluntly, but I think culturally speaking, you lose a little bit of the Asian part of your heritage when you are Jerry or when you are a John or a Steve or a Sally. But, you know, we evolve, and I don't know where that will mean or what that will mean for our children growing up too.
Yeah. So and I'm going to stay here for a while, and I wasn't expecting to go here, but I 100% agree with names being difficult, and there's a balance that you're trying to strike, because as a, you know, African American from historically previously enslaved generations, I know that my name is not from a lineage, you know, from the last name perspective of my ancestors. And then also being married to a Mexican American woman who, as we got married, we had the conversation that she didn't want to take on this very American name and lose that heritage that she had from her, you know, lineage and whatnot. And so it is interesting how we do that. But at the same time, I think about how I take pride in my name because of the things I've been able to accomplish that are associated with it. And so it's like, where do you draw that line on whatever the name is? To your point, it could be Tom, Jerry, Matt, whatever, that I've established something for this that will go forward. But I also want to also have that historical or that cultural relevance that doesn't get completely whitewashed out. And so it is a very hard to solve, hard to land on thing that all of us have to go, not only individually, but as you mentioned, when you're having kids. And it's something that I don't think, unless you go through that experience, you don't think about it and know what goes into. Yes, when I'm naming my children, I'm thinking about 10, 20, 30 years down the line, when they go to an interview, when they submit their application to a school, when they're looking to join a club, that's the first thing someone's going to see is a name. And so it's much heavier than just choosing, you know, what happens to be the name of the year, the thing that I always wanted to pick that a lot of us, you know, have to think about and deal with.
But it's been documented objectively that people with non-white sounding names suffer. Yep. Even from, you know, something as simple as a resume review,
yep.
or that there are, you know, assumptions made on language skills or intellect, you know, particularly in sort of the professional worlds that we, you know, both coexist in, that, you know, whether you're born here or not, like international students that come here in college or grad school, like, do you pick up that name that people put in quotes and saying, hey, there's no record of me being Bob, but call me Bob because it makes me blend in. And then how much of that, you know, and to be frank, like, not to get so philosophical, but like names are made up, right? Yeah. Like names are man-made things. I am very proud of my family name and what it stands for and what my ancestors did. But at the end of the day, like, am I willing to die for my name? People have, right? Yeah, people have. Yeah. But I also have Asian American friends who literally changed their names. So I have a friend, his last name is King, K-I-N-G, Chinese American family. Their original last name is Wang, which means king. But a couple of generations ago, they decided, we don't want to be discriminated against for being Wangs in America, so we're just going to legally change all of our names to King. And so that's like where I sit now, like that sucks.
Yeah.
I understand why they did it. But the fact that they had to do it just ruins me because you're losing a little bit of, you know, what makes you. And then that's really, really hard.
Yeah, totally. So I do want to touch on a little bit of your background as well, because, you know, you said you went to high school on the East Coast in the Bronx. Then you then go to the West Coast for college. Mm-hmm. What led you to go West, or what did that experience, you know, what were you seeking in that experience making that shift?
Well, I mean, one, I think where we were originally from the LA area. So I think my parents had a desire to move back and keep us together. The reality is though, I failed that one college application, and it was forced because we moved to New York for my father's second medical residency program, which was a 3-year program. And so we moved the summer before my freshman year in high school. My brother is a year ahead of me. So he graduated in the summer of 2000 and was coincidentally headed back to LA to go to UCLA. And so during the fall of 99, my parents knew that when his program was over, he wanted to move back to LA to set up his practice. I said, okay, Jay's fine, but what the hell do we do with Jerry? Because I didn't. And so they presented with me a number of different options, right? Like, do you want to go back to the city we were in before and wrap up high school there with your old friends? I said, no, you know, I attended, you know, I guess objectively prestigious high school, and I wanted that Bronx Science diploma and knew that it could help me in life. And it was something that I really wanted to be proud of. And the idea of me staying behind in New York City by myself as a 17-year-old just to finish senior year of high school, when that doesn't make any sense either. And we weren't in a financial position to be able to accommodate that. Somehow, some way, through the work of my ninja mother, who just happens to find these things out, USC has still to this day a program that admits high school juniors a year ahead of schedule for students largely from rural areas who have exhausted their academic curriculum and are basically tapped out or bored. And so they find these students and they say, hey, if you have the academic prowess to come a year early. And it was also strategically them trying to pick up kids that probably wouldn't have gone to USC otherwise, especially 20 years ago when the standards were slightly different, let's say. And so my parents found out about this program. They said, great, we found the perfect solution. You just have to go to college a year early. I said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, I had different ambitions of going to different schools from my high school onwards. I wanted to graduate. I had, as an ambitious teenager, goals politically in my student government of I wanted to run for president. I wanted to do a couple more things as a senior. None of that came true because I, you know, yes, I did it because it was what was good for the family. But when you're 16 and you're like, F this, I just want to do something. Why am I being forced to do any of this? It was hard. Yeah. But anyway, I filled out one college application, the early program at USC, got in, you know, everybody knew I was leaving early. So like, I couldn't run for anything. People were just like, all right, well, you're going to leave. Yeah. Luckily, and I made this sort of conditional, not that it would have made a difference. I had a good relationship with the principal. And I said, look, Mr. B, I need to go to college early. You understand my situation, but I want your assurance that one, I get a diploma and that I can come back and walk at graduation and you know, shake your hand. He said, deal. And so I actually graduated high school after my freshman year of college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we flew back to New York after my freshman year had wrapped. You know, I was 17 years old as a college freshman using my 18-year-old brother's ID to get into places, and, you know, or to buy things. But, you know, that was, you know, really, I don't even want to say a sacrifice because it was a non-decision, but something that was done for the family. Yeah. My life has, you know, gone in such an amazing way. Obviously with some setbacks and some speed bumps, but, you know, I'm glad it happened that way. You know, could I have gone to a different, perhaps a better school than had I finished high school there? Who knows? But, you know, that's sort of, yeah, people get confused because the graduation dates don't line up. and, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, that's a fascinating, again, that's why I said dope storyteller. It's a fascinating story behind what you would never understand from reading a resume, reading, you know, dates or whatnot. And I also like the fact that you kind of came to the point of like, okay, I'm ultimately not going to get my way on some of these things, but there are some things that I need to happen. And there, you know, I want to be able to graduate with my peers. I want to be able to come back and have that. So that's phenomenal.
Well, you know, Matt, to be frank with you, the initial intention was to go to USC and then transfer out. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered alcohol. And so my grades were not, or I also discovered that the fact that nobody cares if you actually went to class or not.
Yeah.
There's nobody like waking you up to like keep you accountable.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't transfer out. But
yeah, that senioritis hitting in your freshman year of college is an interesting combination.
Yeah. You're like, and you're like, oh yeah, 8 a.m. sounds really good when you're in high school, right? They're like, yeah. Oh, that's when I go to school now. And then when you go to college, you're like, wait a minute, nobody does anything at 8 a.m.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's awesome. I love hearing those like pivotal moments that, you know, I'm sure it felt like the end of the world at the time, but it actually probably set you off on your path at that point. So following your time at USC, you gathered a number of experiences, I would say probably consistently across the sales sides of companies and organizations. How did you make that decision to kind of venture into that world and what did you take away from it?
I think I knew early on that I wanted to be that I had a knack for people. I enjoyed speaking to people. We now know it as storytelling. We now call it relationship building. But at the time, it was just, you know, I was not academically, it didn't interest me very much. And so things like finance, which was sort of the preferred choice for my peers, or even accounting, you know, consulting wasn't really in our vernacular back then. And so, you know, out of sort of, you know, not knowing what I wanted to major in on the application, I was like, I guess I'll just choose business. Starting to take a bunch of classes. And the marketing classes interested me a lot. Got to know a professor who later became the dean of the business school. And, you know, he said, if you want to be a leader, get to know people. And the best way to get to know people as a young person is to go be sales. I said, you know, knowing what I know now about identity and culture and all that stuff, obviously it was an old white guy telling me this advice. And so for people like me and you, it's slightly different. But from his perspective, it's like, you know, X number of current CEOs in the Fortune 500 list all started in sales. And so, again, without ever somebody telling me that I can't be a tall white guy, I said, well, that really sounds like a good way for me to build up, you know, a baseline of skills and whatever to go. And so, and I just really enjoyed it. You know, it's funny. So upon graduation, I had three job offers, all with sales as a function. One was with where I eventually ended up going, selling new homes at Pulte Homes. The second one was with Gallo Wine, being a district manager selling wine. And then the third one was with Altria, or formerly known as Philip Morris, being a territory manager for cigarettes. It's like, all right, cool. I can go sell booze, cigarettes, or homes. I'm going to go with homes because that's the easiest thing for my mom to have to explain at church of what Jerry's doing. That's like, that was my decision-making process. It was 2004. The real estate market was on fire back then for those of you old enough to remember what that felt like. And so thus began sort of my career in sales. Try to outtime or outpace the market changes. Move started in a city called Bakersfield out here in California, which is not so rural, but, you know, was a very, very high growth area, but also suffered the most from the housing bubble in 2008. Relocated back closer to home in a more urban setting in Los Angeles, selling condos and lofts downtown. Jumped around to sort of ancillary industries like mortgages and insurance, you know, ultimately deciding that I wanted to go back to graduate school and try something, or at least accomplish something that I couldn't do or didn't do coming out of undergrad, which was to have a traditional salary professional job. Because when you're in sales, whether you are a W-2 salesperson or a 1099 contractor salesperson, you eat what you kill, right? Mm. So this notion of like accrued PTO didn't exist. Mm. Annual bonuses didn't exist. Getting promoted didn't exist. You're always just sort of this mercenary person. You know, in my late 20s, I was like, well, that's kind of sucks. Like, what am I doing? Personally, concurrently, when I was selling insurance at AAA, I had met the woman now who is my wife. And so that had a little to do with like, okay, if you want to marry this girl, like, what are you going to do? No shade to the people who sell for a long time, but I think they know more than other people, like how grueling it is and how every month it seems like you have to start at zero. And from a foundational building perspective, what are you actually building in the long run? So, but you know, that's sort of the ability to connect with people, the ability to ask good questions, to listen, knowing, obviously for folks, knowing what I do now, like that all contributed. Yeah. And you just get to know people and you make friends. And I know that now, particularly now, there's a lot of bad sales advice out there of do whatever it takes to get the deal. A no isn't a no. Keep calling them. None of that stuff works in the long run. Because ultimately what you're trying to do is build your personal brand around somebody who cares. And so I think I did it that way. Did that make me the most successful salesperson? No. But, you know, I'm happy with where it ended up.
Yeah, it was funny because, you know, many would argue that we're all salespeople. We're all selling something. And the fact that you were able to, you know, cut your teeth on that early on and take those skill sets into your other ventures and other opportunities, it probably was very foundational and transferable in that perspective. I'm curious though. So I probably get asked maybe once every, if not month, every 3 weeks by someone like, should I go back and get an MBA? How it sounds like you had a very specific reason for why you were going to go do it and make that shift in your professional journey. But yeah. I'm curious, when people ask you that question, what is your rationale, or how do you help people through that decision process?
I ask them what they want to be known for when they die. Because too many people think of it just like I did, which is very, not even strategic, but very tactical, right? If MBA, then McKinsey. If MBA, then Google. X number of or X percentage increase in salary minus the 2 years of not making any money, break even point, 4.5 years. Very MBA, like silly thing to do, to think of life in a very financially metric way, but it is what it is. People, that's what they do, right? But it's a life-changing experience that gives you the opportunity to take a pause at an early part in your life that you otherwise would not get to do, to meet people from different parts of the world, to experience things and to learn things in a very hands-on and experiential way that you're never going to get to do. And more than anything else, it really does put you in a different network. I don't want to say better or worse, but a different network of people that you would not have otherwise have access to. So, you know, jobs come and go, money comes and goes. One of the very few things that will stay with you forever is a degree. And so for until the day I die, I can say, you know, you're not going to rescind my degree I've earned. You can take away my money. You can take away my house. You can take away other things that give me credibility or validity. But, you know, you have to think about what does this degree mean for you in 40 years, not just four. And so particularly now, Matt, as people see me as somebody who podcasts for a living or speaks for a living or builds communities for a living, you know, is there a direct correlation between MBA and the investment that I made in myself and what I do? Of course not. There's no sense, right? Like, you know, no love lost between me and the former president, but, you know, the pause on student loans saved my business, right? Like, and so, you know, continuing to think about having to pay that back and what it means for the ROI from an extremely tactical perspective, knowing what I do now, doesn't make any sense. However, how many fresh MBAs are running their media businesses the way I am? Not very many. I was very fortunate this year to be invited to many organizations, both schools and companies, to speak on diversity, to speak on the Asian American experience, to speak to their students about non-traditional paths.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that having those logos on my resume, the fact that I went to graduate school, the fact that I worked at certain places that people find credible, whether, you know, again, sort of this notion of brand safety.
Mm-hmm.
I am a very safe, I know this for a fact, and I'm not saying it to, you know, boost my ego. Like, on paper, I'm a safe bet to say, come speak to our company.
Yeah.
And so thinking about, could I have gone down this path of starting a media company and then subsequently a public speaking business without that experience? No, absolutely not.
Hmm.
Even though I left consulting to go exit to something else, and now I don't even do anything remotely related to that, it all makes sense, because 38-year-old Jerry that went to 10 plus years in sales and then did something else and ended up here is a very different way to tell that story than the way that at least my bio reads, which is, hey, he went to business school, he went into consulting, and now he wants to help those organizations from the outside by bringing in a fresh perspective on DEI and, you know, life journey. Yeah. And so, you know, for folks who are wondering, it's a hefty investment, right? I would, you know, there are so many different resources, particularly if you are a student of color. Organizations like MLT, which is Management Leaders of Tomorrow, the consortium, which I was a member, Toigo, for those of you who want to go into finance, Forte for women, the Reardon Program Alumni Association out here in Los Angeles. There are so many freaking resources, many of them who might pick up your tuition check. So explore it, talk to people. And my last bit of advice in the MBA is, as you explore schools and go to programs or have informational conversations, really, and please, talk to the people outside of the people that the school recommends for you.
Yeah.
Because just like corporate recruiting, if they're sending them to you, you're only going to get one message.
Exactly.
And not to say that you want to people who hate the school or hate the company. You want to get a balanced approach of, like, you know, what is the, you know, I want to know what the least happy person in the building feels about the school, and then to decide, you know, because you're never going to, your experience isn't always going to hit the highs of the highly curated 10 cheerleader types that, you know, we will call them the brochure people, right? The kids that always make the brochure are not the average experience. And so, yeah, and if personally, if you're curious about my experience at Michigan or, you know, other things, like, you know, I'd welcome Matt's listeners to reach out to me and we can talk. You know, that's something I quite enjoy doing still. And our mutual friend, you know, Marcus Collins, look at his path, right? He went to business, he was an engineer by trade, then to business school, then into marketing, went back to get his doctorate. He is now in business and teaching. And, like, so this notion that also an MBA has to be linearly leading to something, in a very strict tradition in the corporate sense, is also a farce. Do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's funny. The thing that I want to pull out of what you said, though, is you talked about being able to tell your narrative and to be able to tell what you took from each step, each experience, each, you know, whether it's job or other. And I think a lot of times people tend to think about it, to your point, of linear or resume-like versus, like, what is the story behind who you are? And ensuring that whatever story you're telling, that next decision is going to further extend that story, as opposed to doing it for the financial reason or doing it because, you know, someone's telling me I need to go do this. So I think that's really important. So I do want to jump to what you're doing now. And, you know, you started a media company, Just Like Media, right before a pandemic. And, you know, probably set out with some very audacious goals and objectives, but I'm curious, how have you been able to navigate this space now?
I mean, it's hard. And where I am now, I think, is contextually, because of some ugliness that has happened in the world, made it really more, it made the audience a little bit more ready, willing, and able, to use a sales term, to listen to Asian American voices. And so how it started was that I think all throughout my sales career, the decision to go to business school, the fallacy of thinking that being a strategy consultant would somehow validate my worth or make me happy as a professional, or, you know, I went from there to, you know, formerly known as WeWork, or I guess still known as WeWork, but known as an amazing place formerly, I guess. And so these are all things as you grow up, you're like, hey, you know, if you work at a startup, maybe you'll be happy. If you make more money, you might be happy. If you go get to business school, you'll be happy. I think for me, because I grew up in this structure of my cultural influence, both Korean and American, who my parents were, who my other influences were, going to schools like Bronx Science and USC and doing what I did, I think so many of us, including myself, we look at happiness and fulfillment professionally in this formula that is not meant for everybody. But yet we are continually encouraged to say, it's your fault if you can't make this work. Because they'll point to another Asian person who seemingly from the outside has made it. They'll point to somebody else and saying, well, just longer, work harder, head down, don't rock the boat. Without ever really giving ourselves an opportunity to explore the idea of the efficacy or even the legitimacy of the formula that we've been trying to solve. And so I don't care what the variables are in this proverbial formula. If the whole damn thing is multiplied by zero because you're working for somebody else, you're always going to get zero. And so, you know, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago to the day, I found myself without a job. And I had a long talk with my wife. We were parents of two. So parents of two, business school loans. My wife is a pharmacist, pharmacy school loans still, living in Los Angeles. And I said, I don't want to go find another job. She said, excuse me. And I said, for the first time in my adult life, I want to bet on myself. And I don't know what that looks like, but I know that one, my message resonates with people, that I can make a difference in people. And I know that my value in the public space is far greater in the long run than what anybody places on me as my financial value in terms of a salary or commission or whatever it is. And for somebody who's been selling professionally on and off for 15 years, I've never been the product. I've always had to anchor my sales or my ability to sell on a home that I had no part in, to office space or insurance, or, you know, sure, when you go on a date with the woman or whatever, you're selling yourself. When you apply to school and you apply to, you know, companies, sure. But in terms of, am I the business, right? And so that led to me committing myself to content creation. I ran a challenge for myself by myself on LinkedIn, creating video content for 100 straight days. That gave me enough confidence and practice to start a podcast in early 2020 that no longer runs, which then that led to the creation of Dear Asian Americans, wanting to leave a legacy for my kids. And so Dear Asian Americans was the first show launched on my daughter's first birthday, really as a legacy piece of storytelling, because I didn't have Asian American stories growing up. And I really think that talking about the broken formula, talking about chasing things that weren't meant for me, what if I had better mentors, both personal and impersonal, through stories where I could have said, oh, it's completely okay not to go to college. It's completely okay to go to business school and then say, F this stuff. It's completely okay to do grunt work, but be happy and make a lot of money. Because when you put education, especially the highest levels of higher education, on a pedestal, you're equally putting everything else in the gutter, right? And that's what I think our parents did a lot, unknowingly or intentionally. I don't know. And so, you know, part of this time, I'll be, you know, very frank and vulnerable. Like, I was on unemployment. Like, I needed, you know, I was looking for jobs. I wasn't, you know, I was in process of a multitude of companies that I think I would have been okay working for. And then the pandemic hit, and they're like, sorry, we're not doing anything until we figure this out. And I was like, okay, cool. So everybody's home. I'm home. Got a lot of time. Just going to go all in on this content creation. So, you know, did 50 episodes of Dear Asian Americans in the first 100 days, launched a number of different shows in different verticals. So we have a show for and by Korean adoptees. We have an MBA show for Asian international students. We have a parenting show. We launched and a number of different shows. All the while, to be frank, just doing the work, not knowing precisely when the check was going to come or how the check was going to come into fruition. I don't ever want to be a Joe Rogan type of podcaster, meaning I want to have a defined audience and I don't want to be applicable to everybody. That comes with certain sacrifices of not having enough listens or numbers to get the sponsorship money or whatever. But I was okay with that because I was creating something that I wish I had and something that I want to leave for my kids, right? And so you know, that continued on. I had to pivot into producing podcasts for clients. So thankfully, I had friends and friends of friends who believed in me and believed in my craft enough to pay me to produce their podcast. That, you know, took us through the back half of last year into this year. Got a couple small sponsorship deals thanks to, again, relationships that were pre-existing, you know. Early this year, sort of coming to that point of the one-year anniversary of having promised myself, if I can't make this work in a year, then I have to be really honest with me, my wife, and my kids, and face the terrible, frightening idea for me of having to go get traditional employment because this didn't work. You know, I got busy. I was asked to speak at places. I was approached by a number of different entities and wanting to partner with our brands for promotion. And unfortunately, as I was getting, you know, sort of thinking about, okay, I know it's a year in March, but I want to see this through Asian Pacific American Heritage Month in May, because that's sort of when we are busy. And I built this platform to amplify our stories. A lot of the violence that we saw, a lot of the hate crimes that we saw, culminating in sort of the key pivotal moment on March 16th and when the mass murder happened in Atlanta, fundamentally changed my business forever, because employees, both Asian and not, inside large and small organizations were demanding that their companies do something. Very similar to what we saw, unfortunately, because it's a cycle of what happened last summer with George Floyd's death and, you know, 4 years ago with, you know, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. This notion that companies have to be responsible in making, taking a social stand, but also creating safety for their employees. And so what then happened was, I just, you know, my LinkedIn inbox became ridiculous. My referrals of, hey, we want somebody who can speak to us about what it means to be an Asian American in the corporate space. And again, I could not have planned this intentionally, but here I was, a guy who had the right logos on his resume, that was used to speaking, that had 15 years of sales background, could use empathy, but also I didn't have an employee, so I didn't have really any sort of conflict of interest or anything. Also, I had this credibility of having built, and in March, we celebrated 1 year of the Asian Americans, 100 episodes. I was, you know, getting featured and stuff and sort of known as the Asian American storytelling guy. And so, you know, April and May, Matt, were, you know, just unbelievable. Just, again, under tremendous extenuating circumstances that I became in demand. But to be able to take organizations and people through my community, our history, what it means to be me, and ultimately come out. And this is not an Asian American problem, just like Black Lives Matter is not a Black problem. It's an everybody problem. And I was able to bring together audiences and to move forward organizations, I hope, in a way where everybody began to care just a little bit more. Here we sit, you know, at the end of July, you know, coming off of what was a very, very busy May. And then now that busyness turning into different opportunities to work with some of these organizations, not just in May, because just like Black speakers don't want to be just called in February, I don't want to be busy just in May. How do we make this conversation sustainable and long lasting? And so, you know, my ultimate story is, I joked earlier that, you know, my parents don't know sometimes how I make my money, but they came here to this country for, yes, their own professional ambitions, but in part, to provide us a better life. One of the first things that they did was to take away a little bit of my Korean identity by giving me the name Jerry. And yet here I am almost 30 years later, 29 years later, making my identity, my personal brand, and my family's generational income on being me. And so for everybody else who's been made to feel shameful about the color of their skin, their gender, the way they were born, being able to, or being forced or even encouraged to come up with American names or to go by initials, or, hey, I can't pronounce that, so let me just call you Steve. Mm-hmm. Like, there is, if I can do it, and again, I say that, and I want people to know that I was born with certain privileges and not everybody else has, and I earned some privileges that I continue to benefit from, so I understand the context of this. But there exists the universe where you can find your own authentic voice and make that your business. It's not easy, but it is possible. And this notion that you just have to take crap from your employer or follow this formula or be really deathly afraid to tell your mom that you quit your job even though you're 30-something, which is a very real fear and trauma for many of us. Find your own voice, because I am led by the fact I traveled full-time as a consultant when my son was born, from when he was about 8 months old until he was a little bit more than two. He wasn't old enough to ask me then, but I did not want to have to ask or have him ask me, why do you have to leave home every day? What's so important? So I just wanted to be able to look him in the eye and say, hey, I'm trying to make this world, this country, a little bit less racist, a little bit more understanding. And I'm doing that by making people who look like us humanize their stories and then to share that. So yeah, I encourage people to, you know, I know it's not easy. I say it and it's not easy, but try to minimize the noises of the outside, even those of those closest to you, and to really try to figure out what your story is, what you want people to talk about you. And as we often say, if you work for a large corporation, they're not going to miss you, but your people will miss you. And then what you want that to look like.
Yeah, no. So one, thank you for sharing that. There are so many pieces of that, that not only were you vulnerable, but you're also real, because I think that's the piece that is helpful for others to know, like, it's not just the mountaintop. Like, there's the accent, there's the as you mentioned, the pitfalls, the things that we stumble over along the way before you see us on the mountaintop. The other thing I think that's important, and it's a podcasting thing, but it's just a general thing of, like, you got the reps in, and you mentioned like, hey, I made a commitment to do content 100 times in that many days. And I feel like that everyone is like, oh, you know, I could write a book, or I could do a podcast, or I could, you know, produce a sitcom, but no one actually does the work. And it's like, you were ready for this stage this year to be able to shine because you put the work in. And I think that's the thing, is like, don't be afraid to, you know, record your podcast, and you don't have to even publish it. Just record it and get it out. And I think for me, the reason I do the podcast is selfish, because this is like, you know, this is another form of a degree for me, because I'm able to sit down with people like you and learn from your experience, and you're helping me get my thoughts out, so that when I always tell people, like, this actually helps me be a better dad, helps me be a better husband, helps me be a better employee, just because I'm actually building my thoughts through these conversations. And so I encourage everyone, if you have an idea, if you have a passion, like, lean into it, find a way to feed it, because you have no idea how it's going to benefit you down the line, or how it's going to benefit you in the future.
Shout out to Adrian Lucas at the One Club for bringing us together and making this conversation happen. You know, you bring up a good point, Matt. And I think for young people listening, it's not even a secret, because it's so obvious, but I'll tell you, starting a podcast where you invite other people to come talk to you is the least costly, the highest ROI, and the most authentic way to build a impenetrable moat around your personal brand. If you are a student, so I'll give you a very practical example. If you are a Asian American woman who wants to go into fashion, right? Perhaps a little too stereotypical, but let's use that example. And you say, I don't know anybody, right? I wasn't born into a family of fashion designers. I don't know anybody. Start a show. Talk about the things as a response to your observation. Start to invite people, and not everybody has to be CEOs of fashion brands. Find the junior designers, find the, you know, the merchandisers, have them on your show. Be consistent, evolve, learn, network with those people, ask for referrals. Commit yourself to doing it until the day you graduate. And if you're a sophomore, let's say, you're going to have 100 episodes, but more importantly, you're going to have 100 people in your network, and you don't even have to apply for a job at that point. I guarantee you, because people will want to help you. And yes, there is this sort of, you know, notion, but like people want to help students, right? So if you can figure it out, folks, invite me on your show, invite Matt on your show, right? Like if our story resonates with you, you know, Matt works in tech, like if you're like, hey, you know, there's a dearth of Black folks in tech. So if you're a Black student wanting to get into tech, start a podcast, because there's nothing more, I guarantee you, and I speak for some of my friends, that my friends, my Black friends in tech want to do than to get more young Black folks into tech. Yeah. How many podcasts like that exist from a student perspective? Not enough, right? And so it is a hack. I hate the word hack, but it is something that you can do. It's not a hack because you got to put hundreds of hours of work in number of years. And I guarantee you, folks, also, your life will start to change in ways that you have never imagined. Your network will grow. You'll begin to grow a following in places you didn't even imagine. And so I'll share one more story about the power of that and just putting yourself out there. And so one of the coolest things that have happened to me this year, Matt, was I got an email from the diversity director at Hamilton College, which is a very, very small liberal arts college in upstate New York. My only connection is that I visited the campus on a high school college tour, but I don't know anybody there. I don't know any students there. Zero connection. So woman Paula emails me and she says, hey, I know it's super late. It was in April sometime and we don't have much of a budget, but really, really would love to invite you to come speak to our students for APAM. And Paula, if you're listening to this, sorry, but like the number was great. I said, don't apologize about the budget. I'm okay with that. That I happened to be free that day. So like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And so I get on the phone with her and everything looks great. So we agree to do it. And I said, you know, I have to ask, like, why me? How me? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so she told me this story and she said, I had a meeting with our agent student leaders a few weeks ago prior to that. And she said, hey, you know, we really want to do for something for APAM. We have a little bit of money left in the speaker budget, but given busyness and timing, and they were, you know, going on vacation in a few weeks after that, we'll see what we can do. Mm-hmm. And so give me a list of 10 people you want to invite to virtually to Hamilton College and to speak. And so they gave her a list of 10 people. I was number one.
Wow.
And I don't know any of those students.
Yeah.
And so naturally, I got on the phone with them. I was like, how? Why? Because y'all, like, this is like, you made me literally cry over this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And she said, we follow your podcast. We follow you on LinkedIn. We follow you on Instagram. And much more so than some of the more household names out there, we feel like you get us and we feel like you care. Whew, right? Like, you know, did the check help pay some bills that month? Of course. But that feeling of knowing that I am making impact in a part of the world that I didn't even think about with students and young people. And that's the power of this conversation in the podcast form specifically, when we can throw things into the evergreen universe and don't know. And then people get so stuck on metrics, like, oh, I only got 20 listens today.
Yeah.
20 people could be crying right now. And are you going to like invalidate that? No. So yeah. Please start, learn, join Facebook groups, join other stuff. There's you know, no shortage of resources. Yeah. This was one of the best conversations I've had, Matt. This is so fun.
No, I knew it was going to be good, and I appreciate you taking the time. And I know we're up on time, but I do want to ask, is there anything else you want to share or anything you want to ask me?
Oh, we need another hour for that, to be honest with you. What is your legacy? I mean, you know, I have a pretty unique, fun name that can be personally branded in a number of interesting ways. You have perhaps a better one. But what is the Matt Story legacy that, you know, we're not done yet, right? We're barely halfway through not even halfway through our adult lives. You say you're using this as an educational tool and networking tool. What's the legacy play behind this project or this podcast?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and it's something that's evolving. It's something that, you know, as you said, it is going to touch people in ways I probably haven't even thought of. But I would say my goal, and it's really aligned to where you ended with that story, is that I want to make my tribe consistently better. And my tribe isn't just my family. It isn't just my company. It isn't just my neighborhood. My tribe is anyone that is trying to become a better person, that's trying to make the world more inclusive, that's trying to make, you know, systems and processes more equitable. And we're all going in the same direction. If I can help in any way, like introduce you to Jerry, I can introduce you to people that I've had the good fortune of coming in contact with, then that's what I want to do. Because I think a lot of times, as you said, like, yes, there are well-known podcasters, there's well-known people with platforms, But ultimately, they're not able to get to this level of authenticity. They're not able to get to this level of telling a story that people can relate to. So I'm hoping to do that one conversation at a time. And, you know, I don't you know, think that I'm the best at it. I don't think I'm, you know, doing the most of it. But if I can do my little part that helps someone else do their little part, that helps someone else do their little part, then that's where we're going to be able to make changes. So that's what I hope happens over time.
That's beautiful, man. There is power in doing what we do. I think we come across so much content. Content without context is nothing. And so for you, I think you and I could read perhaps the same script when it comes to life advice. But the way that you would say that would resonate with a different audience than the way that I would say it, right? So it is important for me to do what I do, even though we might be talking to the same exact people, to really be able to basically talk to younger versions of ourselves, right? 100%. And so, and this is why I want to encourage people, not, and this is not a discouragement to other people or downplaying other people. Take advice, consume content from people who look like you and have lived similar experiences as you. Because if it was the other way around, if all I did was wake up at 4 a.m., manifest greatness, work really hard, like every other generic, you know, business book says, wouldn't we all be a billionaire trying to get to space?
Yeah.
But it's not. and that's, you know, as people say, that's an unfortunate reality, but it's a comfortable reality.
Yeah.
Not, you know, so yeah. This has been a lot of fun, man. I cannot 100%. Wait for our friendship to evolve and take us into different places. Really, really an honor to be here and share my story with you here on this platform. Again, to Adrian, who put this together, to Marcus, to Sandra, and so many of our other mutual friends. So fun fact is that Sandra was our class president in high school. I don't know who would have won had we actually competed against each other. But yeah, she was my proud class president of the class of 2001 at Bronx Science. So SQ, if you're listening, shout out to you.
There's an alternate universe where we play that out. I look forward to seeing who wins. But before I let you go, if people want to learn more about what you're up to, where should I send them?
For contact information, jerrywan.com is the easiest place to go to hear my random mix of thoughts on a whole variety of topics, unfiltered. LinkedIn is the best place. And I am pretty unfiltered on LinkedIn. So we'd love to connect with anybody there and to chat about anything, including business school, as I mentioned before, or any other topic that is of interest to the audience here.
Awesome. I'll include those links. My friend, this has been great. I'm sure we will have follow-up discussions and as we go forward, but appreciate you taking the time today. And hopefully you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. And to everybody still, please stay safe, mask up, get vaccinated. So maybe Matt and I can spend some time in person.
Exactly.
Soon.
Exactly. Thank you for listening to this episode of What's Your Story podcast. If you enjoyed it, please hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform, or you can follow me on any social media platform at Maddie Story, and I'll keep you updated on new episodes. Also, if you're interested in learning more about some of the things I'm up to, head over to mattestory.com and sign up for my newsletter. And lastly, do me a favor, share this with one other person in your network that you think might enjoy it. And don't forget to keep sharing your story.